I want to share these thoughts for the week with you first, as they will have something to do with what I have to say. And our anthem this morning, which was lively and joyful music, is an answer to the problems that I hope to address, at least in part. Thoughts for the week. First one by the great English poet John Milton. We all remember him from our high school days, and those paradise pieces that these English teachers ran us through unmercifully so many times. Gratitude bestows reverence, allowing us to encounter everyday epiphanies, those transcendent moments of awe that change forever how we experience life and the world. That's a magnificent little sentence or two there that focuses on those experiences in our human lives that really take us out of ourselves and transcend ourselves and see things in such a larger perspective. But we don't do that as much as we should, I'm afraid. John Milton. The second one is from Hermann Hesse. Hermann Hesse was a fairly recent philosopher, interested in existentialism, and had a great impact in the 20th century when existentialism really began to manifest itself more in the lives of people. And you can tell this one was written by a philosopher, and the other one was written by an English literary person. Wisdom is nothing but a preparation of the soul, a capacity, a secret art of thinking, feeling, and breathing thoughts of unity at every moment of life. Wisdom is nothing but a preparation of the soul. You can substitute spirit if you like. A capacity, an openness, a secret art of thinking and feeling and breathing. Thoughts of unity at every moment of life. As I listen to newscasts and I read newspapers and journals and experience conversations with many people, would that were the case in our world today? Would that be the case? Wisdom. Wisdom seems to be lacking in so many avenues of our life these days. Hermann Hesse. And the last one is from Archbishop Desmond Tutu, a leader in the movement that got rid of apartheid in South Africa. He was educated in England, and he stood strongly for the bringing down of that kind of racial hatred that we found down there in the Union of South Africa. And his little bit of advice: do your little bit of good where you are. It's those little bits of good put together that overwhelm the world. Well, there at least is a statement of hope. Sometimes, isn't it true that we feel that there isn't much that we can do to change things? But the thing is, we never really know that to be the case or not. You never know if you reach out your hand and touch somebody and lift them up and raise them up out of their dilemmas, or if you stand by them in times of crises and help them mature and grow, and they go on and further. Before you know it, they come back and give their contribution to the world. Perhaps just because you took that moment to stop and help them. Do your little bit of good where you are. And we can all do a little bit of good. Somewhere, someplace, sometime, and more than we do it, indeed, as we deal with things today. So those were my thoughts for the week here. I tie this in with the sermon title, and of course titles don't always reflect things correctly, but living the life of faith. One of the things about the Christian community, one of the things about the Christian faith is that we are challenged, aren't we? We are challenged to live this life, and we have a model for that life in the person of Jesus of Nazareth, the one in whom we believe that all the virtues and all the principles that we could possibly believe belong to a God of some type, or God of some type. I don't want to use the word a or there, because that would be kind of defining. But this concept of God, goodness, peace, truth, justice, hope, Jesus of Nazareth is a manifestation for the Christian faith of all of those ideas. And he lived that life. Not only did he possess these things, a challenge, but he lived them. He faced all kinds of consequences, challenged all kinds of authorities, raised all kinds of questions to all kinds of people, religious people, political people, addressing the social issues of his day. Jesus of Nazareth is the kind of magnum opus for the Christian faith. That model, that virtue, that principle, as we would put it in the theological terms, the periarchon, the first principle of our faith itself. And he himself summarizes that up very neatly. What is the sum and substance of the Christian faith? Love God. Okay. And then, perhaps even more importantly, love your fellow human beings. Love your fellow human beings. And not just the ones that you like. Love all of your fellow human beings. Especially, perhaps, those that you do not like or that do not like you. Because there's no other way to overcome differences than to sit down with one another and have conversations about where we are coming from. That was perfectly the case with the apostles when they went out into the world, you know. Peter went out and he wanted to make everybody Jewish first before they could become Christian in those early days. And Paul went out and said, no, that's not necessary. All they have to do is respond to God's love. And they came back and they battled it out. And ultimately, Paul won. Originally, that writing that you read this morning from the Hebrews was attributed to the Apostle Paul. But it's not possible that he wrote it because he would have long been dead by the time that was written. This wasn't written until toward the end of that opening century of Christianity. Somewhere perhaps in the mid or late 90s in some cases. But as you indicated from your annotated comments, that epistle to the Hebrews, many biblical scholars say it is the most significant, it is the most well-written, it is the most comprehensive of all of the Christian scripture writings. And it does. But take a look at all of these. When you read that, you get kind of a hopeful thing, don't you, when you read that opening thing of Hebrews. You know, live that life of faith. You'll be lifted up and so forth. Reach out and do these things. But then, after you've read all of that, you take a look at the world around us. And how do we do that in this world in which we live today? Where there is so much hatred, where there is so much division, where there is so much kind of animosity, even between religions and some of the greatest religions of the world. And within Christianity, we have so many denominations and we have so many points of view that we overlook the central thing that holds us together. And we don't really have to go far to take a look at this. When Jenny read that passage from Isaiah, that's a really different kind of passage. The prophet there is speaking in behalf of God, and he's telling the people of Israel and those around just exactly what he understands God thinks about what they're doing. And they're not doing real well on the scorecard. Why not? Because they keep focusing on everything. And he said, you have forgotten all the things I've done for you. I've done a lot of things. I brought you up out of Egypt. Freed you. Took you through when you walked on the dry land. Takes you out of all kinds of interesting battles with other nations and made you prevail. Took you and raised you up, and yet what do? All you do is crab at me. You know, what can you do for me next? What can you do for me now? And so the prophet Isaiah, and by the way, sometimes I surprise people and say, well, this is first Isaiah. And some people will say then, well, where is 2nd Isaiah? Well, it begins in chapter 40. Because they weren't written by the same man. And there were some others who say there's a 3rd Isaiah. Where's that? Well, that begins a little bit later in chapter 56, 40 to 56. And scholars argue about that, but they all agree that There was not one author of Isaiah because the language is different, the issues were different. But the same principles run through. God is speaking out. And some beautiful passages in Isaiah. In that second Isaiah from chapter 40 to 55, we have the suffering servant passages. And we know that one about, we read in chapter 52, verse 13 to 53, 12. You know, where he stands before his captives like a sheep before his shearers. Opens not his mouth and stands up there. The suffering servant. This is God's manifestation here. This is what we are about. And we have other types of things. So we look at these things. We look at these readings. And we go back and see, how do we comport all of this wonderful, energetic, positive reinforcement that we get in the epistle to the Hebrews when we have all of this other stuff behind us? How do you put them together? And you don't get much help. There is actually another reading in the lectionaries for this day from Luke chapter 12. You can go back and look at it for yourself if you like. And in it, God is angry with humanity again. How do we take care of that? How do we take care of that? And there are so many, many issues that we have to deal with. When I was reading and researching for this week's notes and this week's comments, it reminded me again of one of my favorite theologians and one that we are going to talk a little bit again about in my class on the next meeting on Tuesday, August 27th, Dietrich Bonhoeffer. And Bonhoeffer is a great, great illustration of living the faith. I don't know if you know much about him personally, but he came from a very, very prominent family in Germany. His father was professor of psychiatry at the University of Berlin. His brother was a well-known attorney. He was a graduate of the theological academies in Germany. And they were very, very prominent. Of course, they were right there smack dab in the middle of the rise of Nazi Germany. And Adolf Hitler was smart enough to try to capture the church. And he did. And you had a German Christian church. And the German Christian church moved at the behest of Adolf Hitler. And Dietrich Bonhoeffer turned away from the German Christian church. And he joined and united with an underground group called the Confessing Christians in Germany. And they challenged Adolf Hitler on all of his social and political avenues. And much of Bonhoeffer's family was executed. I had the opportunity of meeting his biographer and one of his students, Eberhard Betke, who finished Bonhoeffer's book on ethics, and who married Bonhoeffer's niece. And that was a trip because they would give lectures at the academy at the University of Geneva. And Betke would get up and he would say these things about Dietrich. And then his niece would get up and say, "Well, I'm not sure Uncle Dietrich would agree with you on that." And she would go off on another tangent. But in that process, you could see how these things were working all the time. So Bonhoeffer challenged the political authority, the religious authority, the social authority, all authority in Germany. He was well-educated. He studied at the University of Heidelberg and University of Tübingen and came to the United States and studied at Union Theological Seminary in New York. But he went back to Germany to challenge Hitler face-to-face. And he was eventually arrested and put in prison. And while he was in prison, he continued to write. If you really have an opportunity, if you want to really see the inside of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, you should find a little book called The Letters and Papers from Prison. He smuggled these things out to his long-term fiancée. They never did marry. But in those letters and papers from prison, he challenged the church to rise up and address these things. He described, and I remember the first time I heard this, it was such a strange expression. He described what he called, the world is now experiencing religionless Christianity. And the world has come of age. These are phrases of his. And they are magnificent phrases because he was describing exactly what was happening. Religionless Christianity, by which he simply meant, you know, the church, like the German Christian church, you know, that was a religious Christianity with all of the forms, with all of the things that you hop through, and you have an authority that sees that it's done. But the faith, the Christian faith is dynamic. The Christian faith challenges us to break through those kinds of things and say things that are uncomfortable sometimes, to challenge people who are in high positions, to deal with issues that touch people on every level of life. Church is not some place you go to Sunday and you'll be all right on Monday. It's just a little habit you've gotten into. That's not the church. We are the church. You are the church. Everybody who gathers together on any Sunday, they are the church. And we must indeed remember that insight of Bonhoeffer's. It's really, really very, very valuable. And he lived that. He lived that in his life. And I remember, he didn't always have the answers. He would have been freed if he had lived two more days. He was in Fichtenwald, and when he was executed. 2 days later, the Allies came. But when he was being executed, the other prisoners asked if he would compose a prayer for them, a prayer for them as they went to their executions. And he did so, but he did so reluctantly because he was saying that he himself was struggling with this, with all of this impacting upon us. But yet he did. And he expressed his concern, his misunderstanding of why we weren't more effective. And yet at the very same time he said, "But I leave all of this in your hands because you are the Lord of the universe. And there must be some other answer to this problem." And then he was hung along with the others. One of my friends who was a very great preacher in the city of Dayton, Fred Speakman, spoke about Bonhoeffer one time, and he described what he understood his execution to be, his hanging. I have no idea whether it is really the way it happened. I just assumed that he was hung as people are hung. But no, Speakman said, no, he was hung by the back of the neck on a meat hook. For his faith, for his daring to challenge the government and the society, and daring to challenge the established German Christian church, which was under the thumb of Adolf. There's the thing. And Bonhoeffer wrote all about this in the 30s, before this. He called it, the book, The Cost of Discipleship. Discipleship, or faith, believers, is not easy. It is not cheap. And he described what he called cheap grace. Now, cheap grace is what I've been talking about. You can run to church, you get a few blessings, and you leave. You say the right words. Now, this is kind of funny in this congregation because many of you know the Grangers, Ellen and Charlie. And they're fun, and they're lifelong Presbyterians, and especially Ellen. And very outspoken about it. But if you said to Ellen, "Take this up and put it on the altar," she would go into orbit. She would fly. We do not have altars in the Presbyterian Church. We have communion tables. I just laugh. Because I don't care whether you call it an altar or a communion table. We all have different experiences, and things are more meaningful for us in one way or another. But do we really attempt to understand what's happening there? And it's not some kind of magic where, you know, all of a sudden this body becomes something else. No, it's a declaration of the commitment of Jesus of Nazareth to God's love expressed in him and challenging us to do the same in the world around us. I get sick sometimes when I read the reports in the papers or listen to them on the news about what is happening to human beings in our country. Human rights and human liberties are gone for so many. And we jump on the bandwagon to make sure that happens, forgetting that at one time we were in the same position. I remember growing up when I was a little kid, I would saw in the newspapers, the Irish need not apply for a job. And it was published right in the paper, Irish need not apply. Well, they got over that hump a little bit, and then it was the next group. And we have a little bit more difficulty with the next group because the Irish were at least Caucasians, but these people were not. You know, they were brown and they were black and so on and so forth, and they stood out like sore thumbs in our society, and so they have to go out. And we have racism of all types and ethnicisms of all type. And too often, churches have been involved in supporting that. One of the sickest things that I can remember is when I remember or think back and those four black children who were blown up in the Alabama church when they were going to Sunday school. Four children just blasted off the earth. And we have that blasting going on again and again today. And that's not what the gospel is all about. The gospel is opening one's arms and bringing people in, not shutting them out. It is not putting people off in a corner because, well, they're different than we are. Well, they may be different in a lot of ways. They may have different talents than we have. They may have different goals and so forth. But we are all fundamentally human beings looking to improve life. And how can we do that together better? During our controversies these days, I thought also of Emma Lazarus. Do you all know who Emma Lazarus is? Anybody not know who Emma Lazarus is? You do know what you did. Yeah, Emma Lazarus is the poet who in the 19th century wrote the poem that is etched on the base of the Statue of Liberty. That's a little bit in the news these days. Because I remember when I was growing up, I grew up in New York City. And that Statue of Liberty stood out there. And I never went to see it when I was a kid. I never went to see it until I moved out of New York and came back. Although that's not quite true, because my father and mother took me when I was a baby, but I couldn't remember that. I went back and saw, but that Statue of Liberty standing out, and I worked down on Wall Street, and I would go down at lunchtime and look at it and see what it stood for. And it is a magnificent piece. Now let me share the poem that she read, that she put there. And she wrote this in the mid-19th century. She only lived 39 years. She died of cancer, actually. And it's called The New Colossus. And she was referring back to a colossus in ancient Rome that overlooked the cities. And here. So listen. The new colossus, not like the brazen giant of Greek fame, with conquering limbs astride from land to land, reaching out. Here at our sea-washed sunset gates shall stand a mighty woman with a torch, whose flame is the imprisoned lightning, and her name, Mother of Exiles. From her beacon hand glows worldwide welcome. Her mild eyes command the air-bridged harbor that twin cities frame. Keep ancient lands, your storied pup, cries she with silent lips. Give me, you're tired, you're poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuge of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door. To me, the doors are open. We are a welcoming community of people in this country. We came here because we had difficulties ourselves in other countries, slapping religious requirements upon us and all other kinds of things. And we grasped this new idea, and the problem is, after we grasp it and got it, then we build up these little structures all the time to make it tight for us. And so we have to continue to critique over and over again. As I've told my class many, many times over the years, that one of my favorite expressions out of the Reformation is semper reformata, semper reformanda. Having been reformed, but always being reformed. God's love is always challenging us in every age to do the good, to love justice and peace, and to work for it all the time. It may seem like we're not getting very far. I know it seems like that to me many times. But like Bonhoeffer, he said, I don't really know, but I keep going forward. Because God is the base of this marvelous life that we have. And we need to continue to work in God's behalf. And religionless Christianity may not be a bad idea, because religion, as I say, set up walls. The Christian faith breaks them down. So when we read the scriptures, I think we should read them with those kind of things in mind. Not so much getting tied up in all of the words itself, but what is the central thrust of it? And that was always, always, always what Jesus of Nazareth did. So as we come into this closing of the summer years, summer months, I remind you of these things. And let us renew our faith on a daily basis and do what we can to help life improve for all those that we can reach. This church does a decent job at that. But we can always do better. We can always do more. It's tough. Like Bonhoeffer says, there's a real cost of discipleship. There is a real cost to following Jesus of Nazareth. And so many times we forget whose we really are. Pray with me. Loving and gracious God, help us to live this faith in this world today. There are so many opportunities and so many ways in which we can do this. Sharing our substance with others, sharing our talents with others, speaking out in behalf of others for the good, for the just, for the right. There is no bad time to say the right thing. And let us be about doing, living, and saying, and living the right thing. In the name of this Jesus of Nazareth, who has shown us the way, amen and amen.